feels to me like a very quiet morning this morning. Yes? We have quite a few folks who are on the walk for hunger, so we can be very grateful that not only are they walking on behalf of those who are hungry, but they're walking on our behalf as well. So let's just think of them out there. They've been out there since very early this morning. And we had a very big day in the church yesterday. Some of you were here for a tremendously intense emotional memorial service for a young woman. So just recognizing that that's in the space as well, that we went through that yesterday. Well, each year, as many of you know, the Unitarian Universalist Association holds its General Assembly, in which thousands of UU delegates come from all different congregations across the country and meet together to learn and to make decisions together and to be informed about the movement and to be informed about culture and the world that we live in through a Unitarian Universalist perspective. And last summer, in June 2011, that was held in Charlotte, North Carolina. A very high point of every General Assembly is the Ware Lecture, when a major figure in culture or social activism speaks to the Assembly's several thousand participants and delegates. And last year, the Ware Lecture was indeed a very high point. Karen Armstrong was the speaker, the visionary thinker behind the World Charter for Compassion. And Armstrong held the audience in rapt attention, speaking from the podium for about an hour without notes and with great passion and conviction. She wove stories together from many different cultures and traditions, religious, mythic, literary, political, and all these stories illustrated the many faces and meanings of compassion. She built a compelling testimony that the idea of compassion, the capacity, the imperative to recognize and respond to the conditions of others, is at the heart of all religious and moral cultures. She made a case that the ethic of compassion must be lifted up as the most urgent imperative within cultures and religions and countries and between cultures and religious groups and countries. Compassion must become the basis for humanity's future and the Earth's future. I was deeply moved and inspired by her speech. It was so true, it was so clear, it was so obvious. And like the rest of the audience, I was on my feet giving her a standing ovation. I came away contemplating how could we translate the idea into our work as a congregation? How can we really make it alive in our work as a congregation, in our relationships with each other? And perhaps most importantly, how could we communicate compassion as the essence of Unitarian Universalism to the world beyond our doors? And yet in reality, I found the challenge of compassion to be stickier. I found myself getting stuck in ways when trying to move compassion from the abstract level to the absolutely real. How does compassion play out in life? How should it play out? The answer to this is not always obvious. As Shingleton mentions, is compassion just a feeling, or is it more than that? If my heart is open and I feel with and for another, is that openness of heart enough in the situation? Or does it require actual behavior? And then what behavior? What should I actually do to relieve the suffering of someone when I become aware of it? How is empathetic feeling translated into relational ethics, into relational behavior, into action and activism, and even, perhaps most problematically, translated into economics, cultural practice, and governmental policy? And I would just ask you to bring to mind a situation in which your sense of compassion was sharply aroused, perhaps to the point of great concern, maybe to the point of anguish, but you found yourself floundering and paralyzed when it came time to take action or when it came to the question of how. I have so many examples of this in my own life. But it happens for all kinds of reasons. Sometimes it has to do with anxiety or perhaps a lack of courage about how to take action or being able to take action. We're afraid to take action. Sometimes it has to do with the complexities of a situation that just defy easy answers. Sometimes action on behalf of compassion for one party can translate unintentionally into pain or a sense of violation for another party in the same situation. That's always fun. Sometimes we're distanced from the suffering in a way that even though it causes us empathetic anguish, we're unable to make any difference in actually alleviating the pain. So I don't know if this is ringing true for you, if you've struggled with such paradoxes. These are the kinds of issues that Bradley Shingleton wrestles with in his article, The Trivialization of Compassion. And I stumbled across this article just a few weeks after hearing Karen Armstrong speak. And in it, the author explores the many ways in which the meaning of compassion actually eludes us when it comes to real life and real social change. In the midst of his arguments, he takes on the weak points and the shadow sides of Armstrong's ideal. So this caused me to sit up and pay attention. So let's see if I can summarize a few of his points. He wrestles with the fact that while most cultures do have some variation on the golden rule, this doesn't easily translate into a common ethic at the level of, certainly at the level of political and governmental bodies, often not at the level of culture. But in terms of politics and government, those powers cannot be left out of an equation for peace and compassion, either globally or locally. So how do we realize it in policy? Liberal religious leaders, those who embrace pluralism and ecumenism, they can assert a cultural vision of compassion, and they can be an absolutely essential voice for justice, but often can be rendered sort of toothless in the face of political policies and governmental agendas. For example, we can see how in our own politically polarized society, how something like the Obama healthcare policy, while perhaps motivated by an ethic of compassion, intended to create a more equitable and compassionate society, has enraged and disenfranchised a large portion of the population. Indeed, many of the citizens whom the administration had intended to assist through the policy. This is just one of countless examples of the difficulty of manifesting compassion at the legislative level. Another issue that Shingleton addresses is the He addresses this at length, is the reality of being exhaustingly overexposed to imagery of suffering through the media. We are overexposed, and this arouses our anguish and our anxiety about what's happening in our world, near and far. And yet we're exposed in a way that is ultimately more effective in distancing us than it is in helping us to be responsive and responsible. In truth, constant exposure to suffering without recourse to action has the eventual effect of leaving us numb, paralyzed, demoralized, and even apathetic. Another reality is the way in which our contemporary existence tends to leave our energies fragmented and ourselves overextended. We give ourselves to our families, our jobs, a few extracurricular endeavors that we feel strongly about, but how many things can we care enough about to make real time for them? How many people? How wide a circle? From an evolutionary standpoint, we're still tribal beings who relate most instinctively within fairly small communities. That's what we are able to connect with on a real level. It's more natural for us to be responsive to those within our immediate circle of connections, and much harder for us to feel connected to those who are in ever-widening spheres beyond our personal circles. So while exposure increasingly implies that we should care about everything and everyone, we're paradoxically progressively less able to be responsive, less able to sort out what action to take, less able to find the emotional and mental presence to be responsive, less able to find the time or the way to be responsive. Shingleton's article is a bit on the gloomy side. He's intentionally raining on Karen Armstrong's compassion parade. And although I will say I think it takes a little more than a little bit of rain to deter this morning's very committed Walk for Hunger team, so compassion does live on in spite of that rain. But his article is not cynical in tone, but he's presenting a reality check. He's trying to present a foil for hazy, ineffectual idealism. And that I feel like that's a very important thing for us to encounter in a highly idealistic tradition like Unitarian Universalism. We have trouble getting meaningful traction on these things, and so we need to be able to encounter them, encounter the obstacles. I don't want to confound something that should be simple. And there are countless ways that compassion is a simple, immediate response that should be practiced throughout our days. Nor do I want to undermine anybody's conviction about living a life of compassion, living with compassion at the heart as a guiding value. But if any of you, like me, are challenged by the gap between the ideal on the one hand and the reality of living it out on the other, this is an effort to explore what obstacles are in the way of that realization. And confronting these barriers is part of our courageous search for truth, a courageous search for truth which is also at the heart of Unitarian Universalism. So maybe by being willing to think seriously about the things that get in our way, we will be in a better position to work through them or work around them. In spite of the quixotic nature of trying to create more compassion in the world, it cannot be abandoned. It can never be abandoned. At the end of his article, Shingleton reminds his readers of that Hasidic proverb that he quoted at the beginning, "He who feels no compassion will become insane." When human bonds of sympathy are not acknowledged, or much worse, are not even felt, terrible things become possible. Relationships break down, society breaks down, heartlessness and injustice become commonplace, the simple way of things, even banal. And as Martin Luther King said, there are some things in our society, some things in our world to which we should never be adjusted. What Shingleton says in the end is that we need compassion, but we need it untrivialized. Compassion untrivialized, what does that mean? If we are alert to the many ways in which compassion can be trivialized and is being trivialized, we can also be more alert to what makes it personal, tactile, relational, and transformative. And this is what the story of the Good Samaritan is all about, which he references in his article. If you're not familiar with this parable from the Gospel of Luke, I'll just share it with you here. It's Jesus' illustration of the great commandment to love thy neighbor as thyself. And so he's giving this teaching, and someone in the crowd yells out, "Yeah, but who's my neighbor? I'm supposed to love my neighbor as myself, but who is my neighbor?" And Jesus says, in answer to that, "A certain man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. By chance, a certain priest was going down that way, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side of the road. In the same way, a Levite also, when he came to the place and saw the man, passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he traveled, came to where he was. When he saw him, he was moved with compassion. He came to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. He set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. On the next day, when he departed, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the host and said to him, "Take care of him, and whatever you spend beyond this, I will repay you when I return." "Now," says Jesus, "which of these three do you think seemed to be a neighbor to the one who fell among the robbers?" So a little background. The Jews and the Samaritans were 2 Semitic groups that had a long and bitter history. They had intense hatred toward one another, and there were class and power differences between them. So Jesus' use of the Samaritan as the hero of the story was intentional and instructive. It's both a message about overcoming that antipathy, but it's also about crossing a social divide in order to fulfill the call to neighborly compassion. Another detail is understanding that the priest and the Levite who first pass by on the other side of the road, they do so because the cleanliness laws of their religion would have prohibited them from touching the wounded, bleeding man. And so here Jesus is suggesting that sometimes a moral imperative must transcend the conventional protocols. Sometimes we have to be willing to get dirty if we want to do something good. So the Samaritan responds in a very personal way to the suffering of the other. He doesn't walk by, but he stops. He gives the poor wretch emergency medical aid. He sets him on his donkey and brings him to an inn where he tends him directly through the night. And only after having responded immediately in this way with such a personal sense of responsibility to his fellow human being, even though they were strangers to each other, only after responding in this personal way, even after allowing himself to be inconvenienced, only then does he separate himself by paying someone else to care for the person. Shingleton asks, "Can you imagine if the story of the Good Samaritan were televised?" It's a provocative question. If the story of the Good Samaritan were televised, it might create that spasm of sympathetic feeling, and then the image would quickly be replaced by a commercial break or another scene that would yank our feelings or thoughts in another direction. When I read Shingleton's question, the association it brought to mind was Gil Scott-Heron's spoken word song, "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised." What was Gil Scott-Heron ranting about? And forgive me for my school marmish presentation and white skin. I'm going to try to do a little Gil Scott-Heron here. "You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in 4 parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds lighter. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of hairy-armed women liberationists or Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb, Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, a tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. There will be no reruns, brothers. The revolution will be live. The revolution will be live. Otherwise, there will be no revolution. There will be no revolution for the folks whose only experience of it is through the television, through the computer, through the radio or the newspaper. And compassion must be live. It must be up close and personal and sometimes inconvenient to the routines of our daily lives. Otherwise, there is no reality to it. We cannot act compassionately toward the whole world. We cannot respond to every situation that crosses our awareness. We cannot even respond to many of the situations, or even most of the situations that cross our awareness. But we can keep compassion at the center of our lives as a practice, as an imperfect or crucial, imperfect and crucial practice, a daily devotion. And there are infinite ways in which we can meet life with compassion. I think the essential points of the Good Samaritan story, untelevised, are these. Make it personal. Make it relational. Make it about human contact. Make it real life. Take a risk. We have to allow ourselves to be inconvenienced. We have to allow for the messiness of a real encounter. They often don't work out the way we might fantasize. With each such encounter, however, especially those that are much higher on the scale of relational connection across difference, with each encounter, with each risky encounter, each more complex encounter, we ourselves are changed. Hopefully some suffering has been eased, even if a little, even if briefly, but we ourselves have been changed. We know more, we've been touched, we have witnessed something profound. We have encountered another real life that is struggling and striving. And because we have been truly touched, our understanding and capacity for compassion is deepened. And this way, compassion grows in our lives and in our world. If we don't allow ourselves to be touched by real encounter, it becomes increasingly and increasingly abstracted until we don't know how to create compassion in life. I don't think we can worry about the whole world, but we can live and relate and take risks from a place of compassion that actually transforms the relationships that are closest to us, even if it's just in our own communities. And so this is my prayer for my life and for our life. And I just thought would close with our chalice lighting. By degrees, the comforting light of what we may actually do and be in an imperfect world. So we're comforted when we can actually act. Our anxiety is eased when we can actually act. So by degrees, the comforting of light of what we can actually do and be in an imperfect world will shine close to us and all around us more and more. And it is by that light that will lead us, never to perfection, but always toward it. May it be so.